for those passionate about books and reading. Welcome to Read On Live on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're looking forward to the Edinburgh Festival, where this year the RNIB will again host a special event. But last year it was my privilege to be involved. Here's Robert Kirkwood with more.
Thanks, Red. I'm laughing because I'm going to be introducing you in a moment. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Robert.
Now, today's show is going to be live in Edinburgh Festival this year, an event you might remember.
Very much so. It's a pleasure to be invited up to speak at the Edinburgh Festival and such a packed audience as well.
It really was a full house, and we're looking for the same again on Monday. And here's some good news if you're listening to this live on Friday, or if you're quite quick off the mark with the podcast, listening before Monday the 21st of August, while we're doing an Edinburgh Festival event this year. I'll be interviewing author Graham McRae Burnett about his two novels that are out now and available from RNIB, The Disappearance of Adele Badeau and the Booker shortlisted, his Bloody Project. It will be in the Party Pavilion in Charlotte Square at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, as I said, on Monday the 21st of August, and it kicks off at 1 p.m. It's free and tickets are available from the website Eventbrite, Eventbrite. Once there, just search for Edinburgh Book and it's the first result you'll get. Also, you can find me on Twitter. I am talking_books and I'll send you the link. But now it's time to travel back in time to talk to the man who's sitting next to me right now. Red Sale, live at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. Ladies and gentlemen, the author of The Blind Man of Hoy, Mr. Red Sale.
As a boy, growing up in rural West Sussex, it was books that opened my eyes to a world of potential and discovery. My mum always said I was the easiest child to take shopping. She'd merely point me in the direction of the nearest bookshop or library, and while she was gathering the week's groceries, I'd be off exploring the book-lined canyons in search of tales of endurance and adventure. There I joined the voyages of Captain Cook and of Thor Heyerdahl on his Contiki, braved the elements with Scott and Shackleton in the Antarctic, and witnessed the triumphs and the tragedies played out on the Eiger's White Spider. Books fed my appetite for adventure, and it was nurtured by Blue Peter, which introduced me to arguably the greatest generation of climbers this country's ever seen. Men like Bonington, Boardman, Tasker, Haston, and Escort. And I knew from early on that my life wouldn't feel complete until I'd at least tried to follow in some of their footholds. At grammar school in Guildford, I got the chance to begin, first by joining the Army Cadet Force and suffering a year's square bashing for a week each summer, learning to climb with the British Army in the Welsh Mountains, and then graduating to the Sixth Form Rock Club and regular trips to Harrison's Rocks in Kent. My journey had begun, but as any adventurer will tell you, things seldom go to plan. Nothing can prepare you for coming face to face with the Old Man of Hoy. 450 feet of storm-hewn sandstone sticking straight up out of the Atlantic off the Orkney Islands. It's a natural skyscraper, roughly the shape and size of London's Gherkin building. It's Europe's tallest sea stack and Britain's most awesome pinnacle. And for 30 years, I dreamed of conquering this giant, ever since watching a documentary about legendary mountaineer Chris Bonington's epic ascent. It's why I started climbing. But aged 19, with the sky seemingly the limit, I discovered I was going blind, and my life went into freefall. You see, climbing's all about trust, and if I couldn't trust my sight, how could I expect others to trust my judgment? I'd hung up my harness and begun a two-decade battle with my cravings. Now, on Midsummer's Day 2013, I'm standing at the foot of the Old Man, about to become the first blind man to attempt the climb. What little sight I've got left is like peering through a keyhole into a smoke-filled room. I catch glimpses of parts of things, and if they stay still long enough, I might even recognise them. The red Orcadian sandstone is the colour of dried blood, and about as unlikely to move. And I take it in stages. A lot of stages. Martin Moran, who's leading the climb, sets off first. The protection, the metal wedges he'll insert at intervals into the rock to cheat death should he fall, jangling at his harness like wind chimes. I track their progress, trying to visualise the line that he's taking. And after 20 minutes, they stop, and I feel three sharp tugs on my rope, the signal that he's ready for me to follow him. I let my fingers explore the rock, testing its decaying strength, settle on two firm handholds, grimace at Keith the cameraman, and climb to the first ledge. Only another 444 feet to go. And the coffin, of course. And all of it being recorded for TV and radio. But the story the media came to tell is not the whole story. And ironically, it's the parts they left out that make The Blind Man of Hoy a story worth telling. A ninth birthday party, a chance remark, a burgeoning bromance, and the London Paralympics are the signposts on my story from self-destructive former climber to, well, standing here today. In the two decades since being diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, I'd lost 95% of my sight and had to give up all the sports that make me feel truly alive. Writer, climber, and poet Al Alvarez calls it feeding the rat, a gnawing compulsion in some of us that can only be satisfied by pushing ourselves to the limits of endurance. Starved of action, my rat was eating me up. I ached to climb, and Pilates was no substitute. I tried a couple of indoor climbing walls during the 1990s, but low-level bouldering didn't really feed my need to get high at the end of a rope, so I wasn't expecting much when in 2009 I turned up to my local wall at London's Swiss Cottage for my daughter's ninth birthday party. How wrong could I have been? While the other parents were ogling the buff body instructors, I was checking out the bumps and curves on 18 purpose-built top-roped high walls, and I was smitten. If my instructor, Trevor, was surprised by my blindness, he never let on. Rather, he made me feel like I was helping him become a better teacher by giving him a different perspective to work from. And as the weeks passed, my confidence returned, so that the prospect of getting back out onto real rock became less absurd. Then, one day, as I lay gasping but jubilant, having cracked a tricky overhanging problem, and Trevor was waxing lyrical about his favourite mountainside, I let slip my dream about the Old Man. And to my surprise, Trevor didn't laugh. He merely rubbed his chin and in his calm, considered way said, "Well, with a bit of work, you could probably manage it." And for the next couple of years, it was enough to know that my dream wasn't completely untenable. No, and my steady progress was a happy counterpoint to my rapidly degenerating eyesight. No one expected me to act on my dream, but then no one had anticipated the intervention of Matthew. A sinewy blend, of Yorkshire forthrightness and Northwest London chutzpah, Matthew was one of the few other dads doing the school run. Like our kids, we got on okay without knowing each other that well. But I knew enough that as soon as I mentioned climbing to him, I was kicking myself. Of course he wanted to join in. And I wasn't ready to share. Besides, he was notoriously fit and healthy. The schoolgate mums would flutter around as soon as he appeared on his single-speed bike. Whatever physical self-confidence I'd steadily rebuilt was going to be blown out of the water if this novice outperformed me on his first or second go. And it took barely 70 minutes. By our second session together, he was climbing a grade above me. And for the first time, I left the wall feeling utterly dejected. It didn't help that this coincided with my hitting writer's block on a sequel to the novel I'd published the year before. My attempts to regenerate some kind of self-confidence seemed doomed to falter in the foothills while others strode to the summit. That night, I seriously considered climbing on a day Matthew couldn't. I was feeling very sorry for myself. Instead, I was to discover that his indomitability was both inclusive and infectious, and as the weeks went on, our increasingly friendly rivalry attracted the attention of a new instructor, a Colombian PhD student called Andres, who, like Matthew, viewed my blindness not as a barrier, merely a hurdle. With two inveterate problem solvers on my case, resistance was futile. Armed with blindfolds and clipboards, they set about streamlining my technique. Well, at any other time, I might have balked at this interference, but this was London 2012, and the Paralympics had come to town. Day after day, the media was giving extensive and positive coverage to disabled people, inviting the public to look beyond the disability and focus on the individual. Competitors were encouraged to tell their story and did with pride and humility and thanks to those who'd recognised their potential. And it began to dawn on me that mountains don't get conquered single-handed. If I wanted to climb higher, I was going to need to accept the help on offer. I'd also need to learn to accept criticism, which isn't easy when your physical impairment makes you naturally defensive. Undaunted, my two brave companions set about their task. So, the only way to tackle a big climbing problem is to break it down into manageable sections, or pitches. Each pitch then becomes a series of moves, the hardest of which is known as the crux. Crack the crux and you'll win the pitch, and each pitch takes you closer to the summit. The crux of my problem was the amount of energy I wasted between moves. With Matthew and Andres now acting as my eyes, we needed an efficient way for them to communicate the whereabouts of my next hand or foothold, so spent months perfecting a clock face system. Doing this as a team dispelled the frustration that we all at times felt, and it also amplified our successes, and soon spilt over into strategy meetings at the pub. At one of these, Matthew and Andres decided that we needed a target. So I mentioned what Trevor had said about climbing the old man, and my dream became a project. Well, clearly we needed professional help. So our little team expanded. First, high sports guru Cole Styron devised a brutal climbing fitness regime that saw me lose 12 kilos and gain the ability to hang from one arm like a chimp. Next, we needed to hire local guides to organise logistics and lead the climb. With a dozen previous ascents between them, Martin Moran and his fellow mountaineer Nick Carter were the obvious choice, But before they'd come on board, I needed to convince them that I was up to the task by joining them for 3 grueling days climbing training in the Highlands.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, a special live show recorded at the Edinburgh International Book Festival with the author of The Blind Man of Hoy, Red Sail, and we'll have more in a moment.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
RNIB is here to help anyone who's recently been diagnosed with sight loss. Reactions to being told you have sight loss can be similar to bereavement, with feelings of denial, anger, and fear. It's important to know that help is at hand from RNIB. We have an emotional support service that provides someone who will talk you through this challenging time, or just be there to listen. Our support programmes give you the chance to meet people in a similar situation and discuss solutions to emotional and practical problems. If you or someone you know has recently been diagnosed with sight loss, you aren't alone. Call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email helpline@rnib.org.uk.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
We'll be back on stage with the author of The Blind Man of Hoy, Red Sail, in a moment. But also at the book festival event was Angela Preston, the area fundraising manager for the East of Scotland.
The Sponsor a Talking Book campaign is something that we've launched UK-wide, and we're inviting companies and individuals and groups to come together to sponsor a talking book. All of our books are free of charge to blind and partially sighted people, but of course we need to raise funds to get more books into the library. So my role this year is to ask people to do that.
How much does it cost to make a book?
So for an adult book it costs £2,500, and for a children's book £1,500.
And if you sponsor a book, say through your school or through your work, what sort of benefit do you get?
So if you sponsor the whole amount of a book, it's absolutely fantastic. With new technology now on your smartphone, you can record your own dedication to the book that you've sponsored, and that can be either an individual speaking or it can be a whole class or a school, and you can record your own message. You choose your own words, you choose your own voice, and you choose your own dedication.
And we know the Talking Book Service has got an 80-year history, so that's never going away. That's always going to be there.
Oh, absolutely, and we need more and more books into the library. We have an amazing amount of books already in the library, but there's always more and more, and so many people say to me it's absolutely fantastic to be able to read and choose books, but there's always more that we can add into that. And I think there's so many people, we're all book lovers, we all remember books that we enjoyed as a child, as an adult, and really had a profound effect on us, and we want everybody to have that enjoyment.
For more information, search for Sponsor an RNIB Talking Book or head to www.rnib.org.uk. And now on our special live edition of Read On, recorded at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, a return to the author of The Blind Man of Hoy, Red Sail.
The story of the blind man looking to conquer Scotland's old man was attracting attention, particularly after it was featured on BBC Radio 4. Donations flooded into the Just Giving page that we'd set up to fund research into retinal disease. And the messages of support, particularly those from the climbing community and from other blind people, are what kept me going when self-doubt nagged. Then, with just 1 week to go, a TV production company got in touch, wanting to film the attempt for the BBC. And so, Keith Partridge, one of the world's top adventure cameramen, the man behind the lens on the jaw-dropping Touching the Void, joined our team. My small story had just got a whole load bigger. But, as I was also discovering, this meant that I was no longer its sole author. In order to concentrate on my safety, Martin Moran had insisted that he, Nick, and I climb separately to Matthew and Andres, scuppering our plans for a triumphant summit together. And worse was to come, when Keith gently informed me that three characters was also enough for the documentary, making any mention of the vital role played by Matthew and Andres irrelevant. Feeling a bit like the singer ordered to ditch his bandmates and record with session musicians, I tried not to think of Matthew and Andres sitting on the distant clifftop opposite, watching via camera as I prepared to tackle the first pitch without them. I had to flush these concerns from my head. Climbing demands total commitment. If your mind is elsewhere, you'll fall. It's why I love it. At its most intense, I can even forget that I'm blind. I grimaced at Keith and started to climb. 200 feet up, the crux gaped over me, a bottomless, three-sided chimney running deep into the rock and topped by the old man's monstrous, overhanging belly. It's so difficult to climb out of, it's known as the coffin. If I fell here, it was game over. I'd end up suspended in midair, held at the end of Martin's rope, but unable to regain the rock face. Nick was standing by, acting as my eyes and filming everything in close-up. I used to joke that being blind was an asset when climbing. In my mind, I was never more than a few feet off the ground. But bridging that bottomless coffin with nothing but birds between me and the sea, I was under no illusions about the drop. I inched out under the overhang, groping for a hold on its weather-worn surface, its bulge forcing me out over the void, sapping my strength by the second. 200 feet below, the waves slow clapped as if willing me to fall. And as my foot began to slip, my despairing fingers closed on a crevice. At full stretch now, I jammed my hand into it and, summoning everything I had left, levered myself out and over and up. And I'd done it. I'd cracked the crux. After 5 hours climbing, I stood at the summit, elation mingling with a strange sense of reconciliation. My blindness had brought me here. Without it, these chapters of my life would never have been written. I guess I should have known that the clamour coming from my companions on the clifftop opposite contained more than mere praise. This story was bound to come with a twist, but their words were snatched away by the wind, and I only learnt their significance later, after 3 abseils and a weary slog back up the cliff. Nick's camera had malfunctioned. With no close-up footage, there could be no documentary. Unless I'd like to do it all again the next day. Just to add a touch of jeopardy to proceedings, it poured with rain overnight, lining the coffin with greasy, wet sand. If my first ascent was about making history, then my second was about taking the money shot. I managed, but it was touch and go. 9 out of 10 climbing accidents occur during the descent, and whilst I made it back down to London okay, I fell rapidly into a rut. Matthew and Andres had shrugged off their disappointment, climbed the old man magnificently, and were already planning our next expedition. But I still felt guilty. A rut is merely an endless coffin, unless or until you climb out of it. And my companions had shown me the way. Focus on what you can achieve, rather than only seeing what might have been. If I didn't like the way events had been portrayed, I could do something about it. I started to write. And as I retraced our route, I found a more vibrant story than anything I'd tried to bend into the plot of a second novel. There was a reluctant protagonist, loyal companions, a call to action, a journey peppered with incident, with mountains to climb and a giant to defeat. There was even a false ending. And, like all the best stories, it held a revelation in its final chapter. Of course, all good stories should also have a moral. So, whilst I hope that mine has entertained you, and that I get to live happily ever after, I will add a cautionary note. Storytelling is common to all cultures across all eras. It's how we pass on knowledge, express our dreams and nightmares, and give context to our existence. It's an oral tradition. Our video age focuses attention on a story's visual impact. But just think what you might be missing if you never look beyond the limits of what your eyes can see. Thank you.
My name is Richard Wormald. I'm an ophthalmologist. The certification of vision impairment is making an official statement about a patient's level of vision.
My name's Nick Radford. I have retinitis pigmentosa. When I was first informed that I could be certified as visually impaired, my initial reaction was very negative. All I could think of was, I'm not disabled, I'm not blind, I'm not going to put myself into that box.
Certification is not the end of the road. It doesn't mean we can't do anything else to help. In fact, it means there's a lot more that we can do to help, and this is the process that enables it.
With certification come this whole heap of benefits and opportunities and support. I do regret that I didn't do it earlier. I understand the emotions and the fears, but they really are significantly outweighed by the benefits. For more information about the Certificate of Vision Impairment, visit rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. After Red's talk, it was time to take some questions from both myself and the audience.
I'm just curious, did you use your residual vision at all, or was it a purely tactile experience?
Almost entirely tactile. To be honest, your nose is so close to the rock most of the time that the residual central vision that I have is really not much use. The things that I can see tend to be more distant, where the few pixels that I have left in my vision actually can sort of combine into an image. Actually, a lot of the time I was wearing sunglasses as well, just to protect from chips of rock falling off and hitting me in the eye. I did get a halfway decent view when I stood at the top of the madly gesticulating partners in crime at the other side, but they were a good sort of 100 metres distant.
This question has nothing to do with your blindness, because I felt throughout that talk that your being blind was in a way incidental. I mean, it underlines the fantastic nature of what you did. But, you know, you speak in such an inspirational way that one tends to forget that you are blind. I hope you don't mind my saying that. My question is this. When you were climbing the Old Man of Hoy, did you wear gloves? Do climbers in that kind of situation wear gloves, or do you have to be without gloves in order to be able better to feel the crevices and the holds?
No, we don't wear gloves. We just have hands like sandpaper. For me, that's actually part of the joy, is being able to feel rock, which is 650 million years old. It gives you a great sense of perspective of our short time on Earth and the timelessness of the rocks that you climb. And actually, especially with things like sandstone, which the old man is, the friction between skin and rock is sometimes all that's actually keeping you there. So whilst we wear thin leather climbing slippers, which are very tight, a bit like ballet shoes but slightly tougher, on our feet, no, we've got bare hands. And as my wife would tell you, your fingers get really quite messed up, as do your forearms, your elbows, and any other part of your body that you jam into a crack in the rock to try and give you a bit of leverage.
I suppose it really is a very tactile sport in itself.
Part of the reason I think it's a good sport for blind and partially sighted people is because, especially climbing things like sandstone and limestone, these are rocks with big vertical cracks in them. Actually, it's a bit like being a tram. You can follow the line of the crack and usually find a way up the rock. It might not always be the most direct or the easiest route, but there's usually a guideline to follow.
Now, tell us about your relationship with talking books.
I think talking books is a lifeline. I was an English graduate. I am an English graduate. I've always wanted to write. And as any writer will tell you, you need source material. You need other people's books to help you write, partly for ideas, partly for inspiration, partly just that you might hear something and read something and disagree with it so violently that it makes you want to put finger to keyboard. And I really got very depressed when I started losing the ability to read. A book which would have taken me 2 or 3 days to read was taking me 2 or 3 weeks. And I think next to not being able to see my wife and children, that was actually the bitterest pill that I had to swallow. So without talking books, I wouldn't have a doorway into the library that I love. And I would feel far more isolated than my blindness actually makes me feel anyway.
And I know the answer to this. You would say you're a heavy user.
I'm a very heavy user. I'm on about 2 books a week, mate. It's great. I can do the ironing and the cooking and listen to an audiobook. I could never do that with a paperback in one hand. I probably am reading far more than I ever used to.
I loved when I spoke to you before, you talked about a glitch in the system where you would get random books.
Yeah, I've had some brilliant random books. I've got Lord knows where they came from. But, you know, books that I would never have sat down and picked off the shelf myself. I can't I think it was Sunlight Over the Chimneys or something, which was a brilliant book about a woman who became wheelchair-bound when she was about 10 years old, and her awful life in the Goebbels, if I hope I've pronounced that correctly, in Glasgow. And it was just the most thoroughly life-affirming book, and it was exactly the kind of title that I just would never have gone for otherwise. So, yeah, no, I love the glitch in the system. It's not quite as present in Overdrive, but then again, I have climber's fingers, so every so often I'll just hit download on the wrong book. So
now, Blind Man of Hoyt is in production at the moment in Braille and giant print and in audio. Available now is your first book, Blind Trust. Tell us about that.
It's the book I always wanted to write. It's about a house husband called Joe Wind, who's living in North London, who, when his friend commits suicide, sees the crime that the police have missed, and there's a domestic conspiracy going on in the area that he lives in, and he and his next door neighbour Miranda go to investigate it, and it leads them down some very dark, winding, cobbly paths. And I won't say any more because I don't want to wreck it, but it's the book that I was composing as a house husband looking after my little kids. And then when they went to primary school, I had the time to start typing away. And it also coincided with the time that actually I was unable to read anymore. And so I thought, well, if I can't read, I'll write. And fortunately, that was before I discovered talking books. So I had the time to do it. And it was fortunate enough to find a publisher, and then even better, it was picked up by RNIB Talking Books, and I got a lovely email last week from the Talking Book service in New Zealand asking for permission if they could do it for their own audience out there. So clearly it's found an audience, which is great. Now I just have to get the sequel done. I have to stop climbing.
What was easier, fact or fiction?
That's a really difficult question. Fact is easier because the plot is already there. Mm. And as I said in my talk, the plot of The Blind Man of Hoy is just that classic trajectory of any thriller. Basically, you have the only way to write fiction is to start out with a synopsis and stick very closely to that plot. You just start hanging flesh off the bones, and that's quite a tough discipline to stick to sometimes, because your imagination takes you off in other ways, and you can quite easily be seduced by an idea or a sentence. So the trouble with the fact is that you've actually, in my case, you've just got to go out and live it as well. So there's a lot of keeping fit and climbing. The next book will be fiction. I'm planning another adventure, but what comes out of that, we'll see.
Any more questions from the audience?
My name's Phil Sawbridge. Just to say that having read your book with enormous enjoyment and now having heard you with even more enjoyment, having cancelled something else in the festival in order to come and hear you, I'd like to thank you for that. And I wonder if you could tell us what other climbs either there have been or there may yet be.
Thank you, Phil. And well, thank you for coming along to this rather than the other event. I hope the other author doesn't catch up with you. There are three big sea stacks, as you probably know, in Scotland. I came back the year afterwards to climb the Blind Man of Stour, which was a great climb, a bit windy, but great fun. And then last year I came up again to Sandwood Bay to tackle the third of the three, Bukele. Unfortunately, the weather was against us with 2 meter high waves and 60 mile an hour horizontal winds. So that would have made the swim out there a little bit tricky. So I've got unfinished business. So I'll be coming back to, hopefully, to knock that one off next year. I'm very keen on having a go at Kilt Rock on Sky. And then in a couple of years' time, I'd like to go out to Pabeg and climb the Great Arch out there. I just need to make sure that my children have something else to do over the summer holiday whilst I disappear for a couple of weeks to hang out with a bunch of climbers and mess around on rock. I'm also quite tempted to go out and do some stuff in the Alps, but I'm still trying to persuade my wife that this is a good idea. And but we'll see. Before that, I'll be heading out to Sardinia with my climbing partner, Matthew, hopefully in October, to mess around on the limestone out there and put some grazes on my hands.
You're listening to a special live recording of Read On from the Edinburgh International Book Festival. We'll have more from Red Sail in a moment, and we'll also hear a live reading of the story that won the recent RNIB writing competition.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
In a moment, we'll return to Red Sail, and we have a special guest on stage reading the winning entry of the recent RNIB Members Writing Competition. Imogen Wild narrates Talking Books, which sometimes sound like this.
Breakfast! 7-year-old Izzy Clark heard her mum calling from the kitchen and reluctantly switched off Pet Club, her favourite TV programme that she watched every Saturday morning. It featured all sorts of great animals.
Hi, I'm Imogen Wild. I'm an actress and an audiobook narrator.
Izzy would love to have a pet, but Mum and Dad didn't want one. Izzy liked dogs and cats, but she really loved unusual pets.
Yeah, it's a great privilege, actually, to get to narrate them, because obviously as an adult I don't read children's books now, but it's a massive treat to get to read them. And all the ones I do, they tend to be about sort of feisty little girls, which I really enjoy. That is great. It's such an enjoyable job.
And we'll hear Imogen live on stage in a moment. But now let's return to the Edinburgh Book Festival and Red Sail.
Now, every year RNIB have a writing competition, and last year you were one of the judges. How was that?
It was great fun. I love short stories. It's not the discipline that I'm particularly good at, and I'm in great admiration of anybody who can put a story into 1,000 words. So it was a very challenging ask for the writers, and a great pleasure certainly for me being a judge, and I was delighted to be asked.
Now, the winning story was by Sherilee Rogan. It's called Diversions. Last year's theme was Journeys. And to read it, here's Imogen Wild.
So far, the coma has lasted 2 weeks. It's not so bad. Mostly, there's just a lot of waiting. There are beeps and whirring that mark the time. And me. The machines that are keeping me going, I suppose. It's hard to tell with your eyes closed. I can feel the bed under me and the tubes in my throat, the needles in my skin, but not much else. I miss feeling. The nurses talk to me. Not the doctors. They just talk over me. I'm a thing for them. A machine to be kept ticking along. Or switched off, eventually. Not thinking too much about that right now, though. Stay hopeful. Stay positive. Critical, but stable. Unresponsive. No, but the nurses do talk to me. Not much that's really worth listening to, but it's nice to feel like I'm still here in the world. They ask me how I am and tell me how well I'm looking and what the weather's like. Sunny, apparently. I miss the sun. Any kind of weather, really. The rain on my face, the cold. The temperature's always the same here. Climate controlled. But some conversation is better than nothing. Is one person talking a conversation? Wonder what they'd do if I replied. I wonder if they'd notice. Mostly I think they are on autopilot. Friendly, professional, but not really paying attention. Not that there's much of me to pay attention to at the moment, to be fair. I'm not at my intellectual best. I think, though, if I sat up and started reciting poetry, they might not even notice. The bells and whistles I'm attached to would have to go off before I got anyone's attention. I only exist right now because these machines say I do. I'm just a set of vital statistics, and not the swimsuit kind either. Heartbeat, pulse, oxygen, not chest, hips, and waist. Sexy. On that note, I doubt I look that good by now either. Bed baths turn out to be less fun than you'd think. And they never dry between my toes. I'm sure the shampoo they use is something industrial from the cleaning cupboard too. Salon toilet duck. Because I'm worth it. No, I think I'm probably looking pretty bad by now. To clarify what I said before, there are a few nurses who still seem to think I'm human, which is nice. A relief, if I'm honest, because sometimes I don't think I really am anymore. I seem to have come such a long way from being human. A brightly lit kitchen. A young woman hurries from counter to counter, then to the large table in the centre of the room. She pats the pockets of her jeans and frantically rummages through her bag. Her eyes catch on a bread bin in one corner, and she rushes to it, throwing open the lid as if she expects to surprise whatever is inside. She grabs the bunch of keys lying there and grins triumphantly. Turning, she pauses to pet a small brown and white cat before running out the door. I was so excited that day. So nervous. A new job. My first day. I had so many ideas. Plans. I was going somewhere. Not just a new job. My first career. Low white house. Grey clouds scudding across the sky just above it. The woman's wild hair blowing around her, turning darker in the rain. A quick dash, head lowered against the wind, fumble for keys, then a disorganised tumble into the driver's seat. Not really sure where all that's gone. But of course it's gone here. This hospital. And I know how I got here, I suppose. But the thing is, I don't know if this is the destination or if I'm still on the journey. I don't know where I'm going anymore. Trees flick past as the car travels quickly down a narrow road, one after another, stark and clear against the sky. I always liked that, how they whizzed by, too fast to really see but distinct at the same time. Tree, 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 then a blotch of bright green hedge, flying past but still sharp against everything else. Beautiful. It's good to hold on to the things that were clear. The little details before everything changed direction. The car speeds down a country lane, cutting rain swept away by the windscreen wipers. The woman smiles as she glances at her phone and notes the caller on the screen. Stacy, hi! No, I'm on my way now. I know, I lost my keys. I should still make it on time, though. No, I forgot my Bluetooth. It's okay, I'm in the middle of nowhere. Isn't the weather awful? In the distance, blurred by the rain, another car approaches. So that was that. The last thing I heard was Stacy telling me to hang up, watch the road. She came to see me, but her tears made my skin wet like the rain. In the road, two cars sit at odd angles to each other, the bonnet of one ground into the driver's side of the other. Smoke rises from each, a spreading pool of oil gathering beneath. A man emerges, shocked and bloodstained as he staggers away from the wreckage. "Hello," he says into his mobile phone. "Hello, I need an ambulance." They're all here. Doctors, nurses, mum and dad, even Stacy. They're talking, but I can't hear what they're saying. The machine's making too much noise. Someone's holding my hand. Dad. And mum. And Stacy. It's raining again. My skin is wet. Drip. Drip. Funny that the rain is warm. Is it rain? The machines are getting slower. Like me. Beep. 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 Can hardly hear them now. Beep. Beep. So far away. But it's me that's moving. Beep. Beep. Guess this wasn't the destination after all. Beep. Beep. Wonder where I'm going now. Beep. Here I go again.
Imogen Wild. Thank you very much. That was Sherilee Rogan's Diversions. The theme of last year's writing competition was Journeys. This year is the 10th anniversary of the competition, and the theme this year is Anniversaries, and it's open to anyone with a visual impairment. If you want to have a go at this year's competition, head to rnib.org.uk for further details. Now, Red, what made that story stand out?
It was the standout story, which is not to say that the others weren't good, but certainly as soon as I heard it, and I think a couple of the other judges as well, it has the ability to tell two stories beautifully closely linked and just seamlessly move backwards and forwards between the two from the present to the past, and just the little echoes that you hear of the machinery going beep, beep, beep in tree, 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 and drip, drip, drip. I always think the mark of a good short story is when you actually think it was longer than it was. And funnily enough, I rang the RNIB and I said, "Is that really only 1,000 words?" And they said, "Yes. It's so much... it's so much more full than 1,000 words feels. 1,000 words is not much on a page." I found it haunting. As soon as I finished listening to it, I had to listen to it again. And I know one or two of the other judges said pretty much exactly the same. She's a very, very talented writer, I think, and I look forward to reading more of her stuff.
Now, this year's theme, as I said, is anniversaries. What tips would you give anyone who's thinking of entering?
It's what I say to any writer. Just start off with a clear view of the structure of your story. Don't try and put too much into it. Simplicity, especially with short stories, is the key. But don't just tell one story. It has to reach further out to either something in the past, to hope in the future, or to an observation. So that the present has to be pertinent to something else out there. Then again, as I say, I'm not a short story writer, so possibly go and look on the internet and look for some better tips than mine.
And what if there's anyone here or anyone listening at home who wants to get involved in climbing or blind sport in general, what would your message be?
Just go and ask. For all the sometimes dangerous sports that I do, like mountain bike tandeming and wild water swimming and climbing, I've been astounded just by asking somebody how many people offer to help. My, as you heard me say, my climbing instructor, Trevor, said that teaching me made him a better teacher, and now actually he teaches kids with learning difficulties as well. And I know my swimming partner, Len, is in the audience here today, and I don't know what swimming with me has taught him, other than patience, and how to breathe with a mouthful of water. but there is always someone out there who will help you, and you're not imposing on them. Quite often, you're just giving them another perspective to see life from, and just go out and ask and do it. The world is full of people who would love to help if you only ask the question. And I think sometimes I myself, and I think other people with sight loss, can be a little bit reticent about feeling that they impose. And yeah, okay, every so often you're going to get somebody who's, you know, doesn't want to help. But, you know, I've found 9 out of 10 people I've asked to have been helpful. So just get out there and do it. And there's a big world out there to explore.
Red Sail, thank you very much.
So that's all we have time for this week. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, you'll find all our past shows, complete with exclusive interviews and more, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.
And tickets are available for this year's event with Graham McRae Burnett. Just talk to me on Twitter at talking_books and I'll send you the link. The event will be in the Party Pavilion at the Edinburgh Book Festival on Monday the 21st of August at 1 p.m. My Twitter handle is talking_books.